Hi, I'm Jim Folzerano, and this is the Guardian Weekly podcast for October 22nd, 2008. This week, we present a special program, Understanding the Crash. We will look at the latest global economic meltdown through the eyes of economist John Kenneth Galbraith. His theme of themes and his perpetual warning was that instability and occasional mass insanity lies at the heart of modern capitalism. I asked Stephen Dunn, author of the forthcoming book, The Economics of John Kenneth Galbraith, to explain Galbraith's importance in financially perilous times like these and introduce him to a new generation of market speculators.
Galbraith was one of the intellectual titans of the 20th century. He was an advisor to successive Democratic presidents and presidential candidates, and he spoke of the challenges that the affluent society presents to us, and he identified the financial instability of modern societies and Western economies.
Now, you talked about the affluent society. Give us a sense of what his theme was there.
The Affluent Society is a really interesting book because he identifies the enormous technological progress and the rise in living standards that we were witnessing in the post-war era. But he highlighted how that was highly inequitable and largely arbitrary in terms of the division of and distribution of wealth. And he identified how we should be able to respond to that poverty as an affluent society and really tackle the under-provision of social housing, of major unemployment and pockets of deprivation. And it was really a very insightful book that continues to be relevant today.
And of course, the idea that the affluent determine not only economic policy, but in a large measure, political policy, social policy.
Absolutely, absolutely, and largely created in their own interests, and that needs to be challenged. And I think Galbraith did that with tremendous wit and lucidity.
Now, what is Galbraith's relevance for economic times such as these?
Well, I mean, Galbraith, like Keynes in the 1930s, basically identified the instability of capitalism in terms of the drive to accumulate excessive wealth and the fragile nature of the financial system. And he basically identified the fact that all stock market bubbles seem to be a good idea at the time, but ultimately it's the financial genius before the fall. And he identified how in the grip of euphoria and excess and speculation that the market contains its own momentum to drive it to increasingly dizzier heights. But ultimately, there is a hangover to come, and he identified that with, great reflection, great insight into the minds of the very rich, the masters of the universe, and how they ultimately are humbled by their own hubris.
Now, a lot of people have been saying that one of the most widely read books at this particular time is Galbraith's The Great Crash, 1929. How is this different from 1929, and how is this similar to 1929, than the Great Crash of 2008, if we may call it that?
Sure. I mean, it was quite interesting because what happened in the Great Crash, there were major buybacks of stock of investment trusts. They were desperate to shore up their share prices, and there was a massive outflow of cash from those investment trusts just when they needed that cash the most. Galbraith wrote that they bought their own worthless stock. He had a lovely phrase where he said, "Men have been swindled by other men on many occasions. The autumn of 1929 was the first occasion when men did a large-scale swindling of themselves."
Indeed.
And we've seen that in 2006. Royal Bank of Scotland spent £1 billion buying 53 million of its own shares at £18 a share. A few weeks ago, the shares fell by 39% just to about 90p. So, and HBOS has similarly done the same. So they're in the 90% club of losers. They've swindled themselves. They thought they had it all, and they've now crashed. And that is, very similar in terms of how the same sort of features of financial crisis sort of typify both 1929 and the present crisis.
One final question. Galbraith died 2 years ago. He would have been 100 years old this month. If he were here right now, what would he say, and in what tone would he say it?
Well, I think Galbraith would say that governments must be prepared to spend their way out of trouble. They must be prepared for deficits to rise. He would say global action needs to be coordinated by governments and bankers to make a difference. He would argue that fiscal policy should be combined with governments running deficits. He argued for progressive taxation and fiscal policy was necessary to reduce the income inequality and poverty as a result of the social imbalance that's generated by the new industrial state. So he would argue for for proper investment in decent public services, and he would argue for the protection of environment. And I think Galbraith is more relevant and needs to be more widely read now than ever before.
That was Stephen Dunn. Before the latest market crash, as they set out to write their book, Unjust Rewards, Greed and Inequality in Britain Today, Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee and co-author David Walker wanted to make a case for a fairer system of taxation. Little could they have imagined that the strongest argument for their position would come from the very masters of the universe they had interviewed for their book.
What we did was talk to a number of people involved in corporate governance. We attended a number of shareholder meetings, and we were fortunate, and thanks to some funding from charitable foundations, to organize some structured focus groups with a group of city lawyers and a group of bankers to ask them really about themselves, and particularly to get at their knowledge of where they fitted in the broad distribution of incomes. And as you might expect, it turned out that they had a very inadequate knowledge of their own objective placing and tended to take the line, of course, no surprise, that every pound paid to them was, of course, completely justified. And even if they were earning £500,000 a year or £1 million a year, that, of course, was perfectly natural and proper because of their justified place in the order of things.
Polly, let me ask you this question. One of the things that comes up again and again in your interviews with these people is their perception that public money is always misspent. Why should they pay taxes? Because the government always squanders the money. And as you know, John Kenneth Galbraith made the distinction between what he called private opulence and public squalor. That is to say, for most people, the idea that someone will spend £5 million building a Mayfair mansion is perfectly sensible. But the idea of spending £5 million on an NHS clinic is outrageous. A misuse of taxpayers' money. What do you think is going to happen to that perception in light of the fact that these bankers are now having to benefit, if not beg, for public funds to bail out their banks?
Well, I think there are three reasons why they hang on to that extraordinary worldview. The first is pure right-wing ideology. The state is always bad. Shrink the state whenever you can. Reduce taxes. Get the state off everybody's back. That whole view of the world they embrace, but they embrace it for very good reasons. First of all, sheer selfishness. They don't want to pay. They don't want to pay taxes. They know taxes are likely to fall slightly more on them, or as they perceive it, because they say, well, we overall contribute vastly more. They don't accept the fact that in this country and in many others, in terms of proportion of their incomes, they actually pay much less than the middle or the poor in terms of taxes and the low paid. The next point is that they are so isolated that they have no idea where they fit into the ordinary world, how extraordinary they are. They live in a bubble. They live in a gated community. They travel in darkened windows cars to a great glass towers in Canary Wharf or in the city. They travel by private jet. They see nothing. They know nothing of the world. They perceive that they don't need any of those taxes ever spent on them. They're never going to use it. Their children aren't going to use it. They're not going to use the health service, the schools. They somehow manage to dismiss all those things that we use about the state without even noticing it. Yesterday, I was in a job centre watching what's going on as unemployment is rising. First person I saw, who should it be? But a layman's banker who'd just come in. He wasn't a master of the universe, he'd been earning £75,000. But was he prudent and wise? No. After 2 weeks, he had no savings whatever and was now signing on the dole. So he needed the state. He no doubt thought 2 weeks ago he was king of the world and didn't need the government. And there was the government, the nanny state, reaching out its arm to him to catch him before he fell.
Indeed. David, let me ask you this question. You've interviewed these people, you've talked to them, you've really gotten a sense of who they are. If you got to re-interview them now, after they've gone with their begging bowl to the government, and this is the part that probably would have pleased Galbraith the most if he had lived to see it, what would you say to them?
Well, we actually do hope for the paperback edition of the book to replicate some of those interviews, so we may have the chance. But, the answer to your question is, surely you must now exhibit a degree of humility, intellectual humility. It's been conclusively shown you did not know what you were doing. Now, what follows from that is you didn't know what you were doing, but you were claiming and getting huge bonuses and payments on the back of not knowing what you were doing. You, O banker, must accept there is no coherent relationship between what you've been paid and your product. So the very first thing I would ask them to accept is, as we think about rewards, and there has to be a market for them, we accept that. They in turn must accept that what they've been paid bears no coherent relationship to their output. The great beauty of the work of J.K. Galbraith was that, you know, he said history contains examples from which we can benefit in future. The reason his book on the Great Crash is still being read is because it actually tells us things we need to know about herd-like behavior, about the limitations of economics. That the great beauty of Galbraith was he knew when economists ceased to explain the world. If we can extract, as we should, lessons from where we are about the limits of particular ways of thinking, particularly economic ways of thinking, I think we will move forward.
David Walker and Polly Toynbee. You'll also find Polly writing in this week's paper on our comment and debate pages. She visits a job center. This time around, they are relatively civilized places compared to the bulletproof screens and the angry queues of 17 years ago. Also in this week's paper, while the West has rushed in huge sums to rescue its banks, just $1 billion of food aid has been delivered to the Third World, out of the $12 billion that had been pledged. As a result, almost a billion people are now going hungry every day. On our culture pages, we look at the ancient Greeks. Charlotte Higgins, author of It's All Greek to Me, says here is a realm where the imagination, the emotions, and the intellect can roam free. I asked Nick Watt, the Guardian's chief political correspondent, to explain the political dimension of the latest market crash, whether it will end the Labour Party's strange love affair with the rich, and how it has changed the balance of power in Westminster.
What's been happening on the world financial markets has absolutely transformed the political landscape in Britain. Let us not forget that it's only a few weeks ago that we were all up in Manchester for the Labour Party conference, and Gordon Brown delivered a good speech, perhaps one of the best speeches he's ever delivered. But we were still saying, will he last? Will he last until Christmas? Maybe not. Maybe six cabinet ministers will say, this man is a loser, and therefore we need to throw him out of office. Well, now what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about Gordon Brown as the saviour of the world. Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, wrote a piece in the New York Times which began with this line: has Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, saved the world financial system?
Hear, hear.
That does not mean that Gordon Brown is going to win the next general election, but it certainly means that the tectonic plates have shifted. He's back in business and he's setting the agenda.
Now, in the United States, it's the party of Reagan or Bush that has presided not only over the collapse of the markets, but this enormous taxpayer bailout, which you would think would have some conservatives hopping mad. In this country, it's the Labour Party that's presided over the renationalization of the banks and so on. Could you comment on that oddity?
Well, absolutely. It is interesting, as you say, that you have the Republicans on the right doing sort of things that maybe mad socialists would never do. But certainly you have Gordon Brown, who started out as a socialist, won't use that word now, doing essentially nationalisation. And it clearly seems to be the right thing to do. But it's very interesting. Gordon Brown has himself undergone a journey in the last year, because let us not forget that it's just over a year ago that he presided over the first bank run in this country since the Victorian era. It was pretty clear to people at the time that Northern Rock, to save it from going under, needed to be nationalised. It took Gordon Brown a very, very long time to come round to that decision. Why was that? He said it's because I needed to check it was the right thing to do. We think that what it was that he was very, very nervous about being seen to nationalise a bank, because that would look like it was a return to the 1970s, the disaster era of the Labour Party, when they did nationalise things and it all ended in tears. Now, he doesn't think twice about semi-nationalizations of the banks because we've moved on from where we were a year ago. Again, another sign of how the political landscape has been transformed.
Do you think this is closer to Gordon Brown's heart? It's always struck me that he, rather than Blair, was the one who was very uneasy with Labour's love affair with the rich and specifically with the city. Do you think that he's more comfortable now personally because of this?
I think Gordon Brown doesn't have and didn't have the love affair with the rich that Tony Blair had and indeed has. Tony Blair, of course, public schoolboy. He talks quite openly about some of his contemporaries at school have made loads of money and he wished he did the same. And hey, he's doing that at the moment. So Gordon Brown doesn't have that personal interest in the rich. But let us not forget he was one of three architects of New Labour, Peter Mandelson, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. And the decision that they made is that we have got to get in with the city. We have to have credibility with the city if we are going to be successful. And that's what Gordon Brown did in the 1990s when he was Shadow Chancellor in the run-up to that 1997 general election. So he certainly had no problem with, in a sense, giving the city a free rein. And one of the attack lines from the Tories, which sounds a bit strange, is they said that he almost gave the city too much of a free rein. He didn't seem to be bothered about the levels of debt. And they say he did that because Gordon Brown's view was, great, let's have the city, they'll make lots of money, and then we'll tax them, and then I can do my centre-left things. And the Tories say, look where that got us.
Nick Watt. This is Jim Falzerano, and you are listening to Guardian Weekly. Galbraith constantly warned against volatility in the markets, its all-too-human causes, and its destructive effects. I asked Nils Pratley, financial editor of The Guardian, if he were a doctor and his patient were the global market, what would his diagnosis be?
The market is suffering from overexcitement, overexuberance, and a bit of overfear, if that's such a word. I suppose what you would prescribe is a period of calm, a period of rest, settle down in a darkened room and reflect on longer-term issues, not the day-to-day action.
Now, we hear quite a lot about the fact that the markets really are rational. And I guess my question to you is this. How can the markets be rational if they're so complicated that no one single person can understand their intricacies?
Well, I think it's probably true that no one person can understand every little bit of the market. I mean, it's important to understand what markets are. I mean, they are a place where buyers and sellers meet and they bring price expectations, but the buyers and sellers are a range of different people, long-term investors, short-term traders, and increasingly in, say, the last decade and a half, computer programs that have been trading shares, commodities particularly, and currencies. So all these people are coming together with a variety of strategies, investing over different periods, and I think sort of trying to ascribe rationality to it is sort of pushing the analogy a bit far.
Galbraith's point is there's just as much madness on the way up. Mm. That is to say, a bubble has to be inflated and it has to be overinflated. And that's really the warning he wants to give. Let me read this passage from his Short History of Financial Euphoria. Quote, "Those involved with the speculation are experiencing an increase in wealth, getting rich or being further enriched. No one wishes to believe that this is fortuitous or undeserved. All wish to think that it is the result of their own superior insight or intuition. The very increase in values thus captures the thoughts and minds of those being rewarded. Speculation buys up, in a very practical way, the intelligence of those involved." Now, what's your reaction to that?
It's a great quote, and I think in bubbles down the years, you've seen that play out many, many times, speculation buying up the intelligence of those involved. I think if you think back to, say, the dot-com era, the people who did very well in those years were those guys who realized that they had got lucky. They had they were sitting on assets that could not possibly be justified, or whose values could not possibly be justified on an economic basis, and they chose to sell up for cash at the top of the market. Those guys walked away, some of them billionaires, and they saw the values of the companies collapse thereafter. The buyers of those businesses suffered very painfully. And there's many, many examples of people on both sides of that trade. Think of Marconi, how it bought cash assets at the right at the wrong moment and effectively killed a great company, or shrank it to a sort of shadow its former self. And there are those guys who walked away billionaires, like the guy who started PayPal. I mean, good business, but probably not worth what it was at that time.
Is it really a good thing that these kinds of wild swings are allowed to occur, given the fact that they can influence the lives of so many people?
But what would stop them? When you say it's a good, is it a good thing that they are allowed to occur? I mean, I think that is the nature of markets, that they rise too far at the top and they fall too far at the bottom. People should bring a bit of knowledge of market performance in the past to current investment, but they don't. Time and time and again, as Galbraith observed, these bubbles do occur.
Nils Pratley. A market crash incurs not only enormous financial costs, but profoundly emotional ones. It affects the psyche of individuals and the mood of generations. I asked journalist Ian Jack about the human dimension of the current crash, about the role of confidence and fear, and about Galbraith as a writer.
Well, one thing I'd say about J.K. Galbraith, I mean, I'm not a scholar of Galbraith, really, but I have read his book a couple of times. I mean, he's a bit of a smartass. We have to definitely admit that about Galbraith.
Well, you know, it strikes me, and I wanted to get your ideas about this, he reminds me not of an economist, but of a satirist. He's mm-hmm. very much like Swift, or even Juvenal, mm-hmm. for that. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's just masquerading as an economist.
He's also very magisterial. I mean, he's handing down. He asserts a lot. I mean, he hands down judgments. That said, he is a wonderful writer, and that book is full of wonderful perceptions. When it comes to the question of this word confidence, followed by this word fear, it almost seems as though human beings can't have these things in what you might call reasonable quantities at the same time. It's either all confidence and all optimism, or all fear and depression. If there was a bit more fear at the kind of confident time and a bit more optimism at the fearful time, you know, the economic cycle, so-called, might be a rather more even thing. But the fact seems to be that it comes in like a kind of tidal surge and sweeps all before it. I don't think it's irrational. People often say it's irrational. I think there's a lot of good reasons sometimes to be confident, more often to be fearful. I think fear, and I owe this thought to somebody else, to Joanna Burke in her book on the subject on fear, is actually quite a useful emotion. You know, it prevents things happening often. A bit more fear, you know, in the years 1911, 1912, 1913 might have prevented the outbreak of the First World War. It certainly would have given people a pause in a way they hadn't paused. I mean, talking of confidence, I think one of the interesting things about that conflict was that people cheered in the streets of most European capitals when it broke out, which is an absurd reaction,
sure.
I think. So I think that's one important thing, really, that these things don't seem to be kind of proportionate in the human personality.
I guess the thing that must have been frustrating for Galbraith, and probably is frustrating for all writers, is to feel that you're really onto something, and to feel that you really do have a grasp of what history means, and yet to be avoided, if not ridiculed, at every turn. You know, because he's predicted, you know, in the course of his life, predicted many recessions. And he was always, let's just say he was not thanked for it.
Yeah. But I guess that would be, I mean, if you look at the last 10 years in this country, I mean, many people who predicted recessions. And it became such a feature of, not in every paper, not everybody by any means, but some people, some Cassandras were there saying this is unsustainable. It cannot possibly last. This is a house of cards. There's no kind of real foundation to it. It's very insecurely placed on a kind of little pyramid of cheap immigrant labor, cheap imports, and cheap credit. People said that. And yet it lasted for much longer than many of those people said it would.
Sure.
So you have to be quite courageous to stick to these principles, really, don't you? You have to say, yes, it may not have happened last year, as I said it would the year before,
right,
but it's going to happen sometime.
You talked about, in one of your recent essays, about walking through Canary Wharf
And your sense was that people really were not afraid as they should have been. What did you mean by that?
I used to work in Canary Wharf long ago, just after the 91 recession, and we worked in the only tower there was, and down one side looking towards St. Paul's to the west. We nicknamed that the Avenue of the Rise of Capitalism. But looking to the east, towards the marshes of Essex, where nothing had happened. In fact, anything that had happened stopped happening. So it was full of kind of holes that hadn't been completely filled in or even completely excavated. And that was the avenue of the decline of capitalism. Now, of course, things changed thereafter. But I must say that I didn't feel that I was actually in the middle of something nearly as traumatic and worrying and completely absorbing as I am now.
Let me ask you one more question. You said that this one seemed different to you, a different degree of intensity or whatever. What do you think the effect of it is going to be on the national mood?
Well, I go back to a very good book on the Depression, an oral history by Studs Terkel, in which he interviews hundreds of people who went through the Depression. And I think the last interview is a woman from Alabama who says, well, it had two major effects, one very widespread and one shared only by a small number of people. The small number of people wanted to change the system, thought this was no way to carry on human life. But for most people, it just meant they became even more fearful, wanted to have their thing, wanted to have their money, wanted to make sure their family had money, wanted to protect themselves at all costs. I think that might be an effect in Britain. I'm sure that kind of self-protection, self-interest is a big, big thing now. I mean, it must be a bigger thing now than it was in the 30s, because in the 30s there was a much stronger sense of community than there is now. So I imagine that's one effect. I'm not so sure about radical thoughts about alternatives. I have yet to hear one. They may exist, I don't know. But I would think that. I think also, I mean, it's quite, you know, I was reading Simon Jenkins in The Guardian today, who's being remarkably kind of gung-ho about the kind of benefits that a kind of a sobriety, as it were, would bring. And, of course, one hopes that's right. I think there will be benefits, but I think it will encourage people to kind of look more realistically at the kind of money they have and what they want from life and how many possessions they need and so on and so forth. But I think it's a very uncomfortable way to find these things out. And I don't think it'll be very pleasant.
That was Ian Jack. This podcast was dedicated to the memory of John Kenneth Galbraith. It was produced by Tom Wolfenden. I'm Jim Falzerano. See you next time.